Okay, great. Can everyone hear me okay? You hear me in the back okay? All right. Well, good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming. This is Modern Application Lifecycle Management and DevOps. My name is Brian Keller, and I was adding up my tech eds this morning, and I think that this is my 31st tech ed, if you count Tech Ed Europe's and Tech Ed North America and some of the other tech eds around the world. And I believe this is the very first tech ed I've ever attended where the keynote has finished on time. So that's always good news, especially when I'm the guy that is keeping you from lunch. So it's nice to be able to start and end on time. So this is going to be a 60-minute session. This is going to be a fairly high-level but broad session. And my goal in this presentation is to give you an end-to-end look at some of the major investments that Microsoft is making across application lifecycle management and DevOps. So we're going to take a look at some of the things that we've done in the past. I'm going to review some of the things that we've shipped since the last time I was here at Tech Ed Europe. We have a few announcements for you this morning, and then we'll spend some time going really deep into some of the DevOps areas that I think everybody should be paying attention to. I'm very curious, before we dive in, quick show of hands, how many people use Team Foundation Server today on premises? Okay, fantastic. How many people use Visual Studio Online? Okay, fewer hands, but I'm seeing some of the same hands, so great. That helps me kind of gauge where everyone is. Along the way, I'm also going to be pointing out some sessions that I think you might want to earmark if you are interested in going deeper in some particular topics. We have some really fantastic speakers here this week. A lot of folks from the engineering team made the trip. It's always easy to get people to fly to Barcelona. We also have several MVPs who are here as well, and some folks from our field who are actually in the trenches delivering these solutions. So I think we have a great lineup for you. So along the way, you might just want to jot down some session names if you're interested in going to those later on. So let's talk about these two terms, application lifecycle management and DevOps. In many ways, these terms really describe the same thing, which is let's help you go from an idea into a piece of code into something that your customers or your software users can actually start to realize. I might actually use those terms interchangeably today between application lifecycle management and DevOps. If you've seen me deliver presentations in the past, you've seen me use this lifecycle diagram. With application lifecycle management, we're really concerned with trying to help you go increase your productivity at every stop along the way, including what we call the inner loop of development and operations, as well as the overall handoff of code from development into operations. Now, we started talking about application lifecycle management before this term of DevOps really existed. Most recently, the term of DevOps has really been introduced to focus specifically on the handoff and the interactions between development and operations. And I'll talk more about that in the second chapter, but I just wanted to give you my perspective that in many ways, these are really the same thing. The thing that's interesting about this is that what we've done within Visual Studio and some of the other tools that you've seen that have been introduced to help teams embrace agile development have really allowed us to go very, very fast within that development loop. But unfortunately, unless you can actually go fast from here into operations, then it's almost useless that you can go fast on the left side of the equation until your customers can actually realize that value. And so that's why I'm very excited about the DevOps movement as being a recognition across the industry that we really need to be able to push over into production and then get the insights from those environments back into our development backlogs. Another thing that I wanted to cover off before we dove into some of the specifics was this brand of Visual Studio Online. When I was here last year, we were talking about Team Foundation Service. And in November of last year, we actually got a new name for that, which is called Visual Studio Online. But really, we're talking about the same sets of technologies. When I talk about Visual Studio Online, I'm not talking about a hosted version of the Visual Studio development environment in the cloud. A lot of people assume that. What we're really talking about is a set of services for development and operations that does live in the cloud. It's actually built on top of Azure, but it provides a lot of the same capabilities that you might be familiar with from Team Foundation Server, and then some special cloud capabilities as well, which were never introduced in Team Foundation Server, but make a lot of sense to bring to the cloud, like Application Insights, which I'll be talking about later. One of the great things about both Visual Studio Online and Team Foundation Server is that they do share a lot of common code. So whether you are using Visual Studio Online or Team Foundation Server, we're actually delivering code into both of those products at roughly the same cadence. Sometimes you'll see features show up in Visual Studio Online first. Sometimes you'll see them show up in Team Foundation Server first. But for the most part, all of these capabilities are accruing in both places. Another thing that I wanted to mention is that even though it's called Visual Studio Online, you don't even need to be using the Visual Studio development environment to take advantage of this. In fact, if you're using Eclipse to write Java code, you can check in your code with Visual Studio Online. You can be using Xcode. You can. I have customers that are using COBOL, storing COBOL. I even have know of some folks that planned their wedding using Visual Studio Online. So really, you can do a lot of things with it. Last I checked, they were still married. So we're very proud of that. This is the first session that I wanted to plug, which is actually happening after lunch today. Nino Lohi is one of our MVPs in Germany, and he's delivering a session which is really designed to help you get started with Visual Studio Online. So he's going to be going from the starting point, assuming that you don't have an account yet, and by the time you leave that session, you'll have several ideas of ways that you can start using Visual Studio Online. The other thing to point out is that it's actually free for most of our customers. So if you have a small team of up to five, you can use Visual Studio Online for free. If you have MSDN subscribers on your team, they get free access. You can even mix and match. So if you had five people who did not have an MSDN subscription, they can use that along with another 10, 15, 20, 100 MSDN subscribers. So let's cover some of the things that we've done since the last time I was here. I started building this slide and tried to capture a lot of the features that we've added to both Visual Studio Online and Team Foundation Server over the last year, and I quickly ran out of room, so I had to prioritize some of my favorites. One of the things to point out here is that the things that are in yellow are things that run on-premises. The things that are in white are things that only run in the cloud. But what you can see is that the majority of these capabilities, which are blue, actually run in both places. And so this gets back to what I was describing earlier about how both Visual Studio Online and Team Foundation Server are built by the same team, and a lot of those same capabilities just start to show up in both of those places. Now, I know this is a lot to look at. I'm going to be talking more about some of the specific areas here. What I wanted to show you specifically was just some of the things that we've done for project management, for being able to track your work. You know, there's a lot of what we call small rock releases in here, which means that they're not huge, big features, but this is based on feedback that we've gotten about some of the smaller things that customers have asked us for that we've tried to invest in to provide a better experience. A few of my favorites here, one of the things are work item charts. So when we moved to Visual Studio Online and we were built on top of Azure, we didn't have the full SQL reporting services backend that we had. And so that caused us to kind of think hard about how we want to deliver experiences for being able to track your data over time. And so we worked with a lot of customers and got some ideas and created what are called work item charts, which you can easily create based on queries. You can pin those to your homepage. And most recently, we added the support for trend charts as well that allow you to get trends over time. So you can see how your bugs are going up or hopefully going down over time. And you can use those to kind of track progress as well. We have also done a lot of things to enable customization of the way that you do your work without requiring that you edit the process template. Editing a process template is a capability that existed in Team Foundation Server for a long, long time. It's something that we do eventually plan to deliver in Visual Studio Online, but there's some additional challenges we're working through there. In the meantime, we wanted to give you ways to allow an individual team to customize the way that they did work without necessarily requiring that you change the process template across the entire team project. And so what we allow you to do are things like customizing the Kanban board. If you want to add a new state, you can do that without affecting the rest of the users on the project. We also added work item tags last year, which allow you to easily add metadata to a work item. You can then go back and query that now, whether that's within the web interface or within any of the clients, such as Visual Studio, Excel, Project, and so on. So those are just some of the things that I'm excited about. There's another session that Justin Marks is going to be doing this week, later this afternoon, where he's talking about how we at Microsoft use Team Foundation Server and Visual Studio Online. This is more of a practices-oriented talk, so he'll be talking about the ways that we've gone into the mode of shipping software to a service, the way that we organize our sprints. He also has a tooling-oriented session where he'll be taking a deeper look at how do you customize the process template and make these tools work for you when you're doing project management with either Team Foundation Server or Visual Studio Online. We also have a great talk that Stephen Borg, one of our MVPs, is going to be doing. Stephen is famous for being able to help organizations really understand how to get the most value out of the reports and the charting capabilities within VSO and TFS. So I would encourage you to take a look at those sessions. I see some people taking pictures. I'll just give you another second here if you want to grab that. And my slides will be available after the presentation as well. In the code area, one of the things that you've seen us do a lot of work on over the last year is really focused on bringing a first-class Git experience into both Team Foundation Server and Visual Studio Online, as well as the Visual Studio development environment. I'm curious, how many people have started to use Git within their organizations? More hands every time I ask this question, so that's fantastic. I do want to assure you that if you're not using Git, if you're using centralized version control, that's okay. We are going to invest in both of these solutions moving forward. It just so happens that over the last year, you've seen a lot of the work that we've been doing accrue to Git, because Git is really brand new for us. But we will continue to invest in the centralized version control system. If you're not yet familiar with Git, I would encourage you to go take a look at Ed Thompson's talk. He's going to be talking about some of the reasons you might choose Git as a decentralized version control system. He'll have a lot of demos that show you how Git works both in TFS and Visual Studio Online. One of the great things about Git is that it's very easy to create a repository and have that checked in locally and be able to branch and quickly make changes. You can make changes on an airplane if you want to, and when you get back and can synchronize with Team Foundation Server, you can easily replay all of those changes along with history. It's a very powerful model, but what most enterprises want is they want kind of the best of both worlds. They want to give developers this productive experience, but they also want to be able to make sure that those repositories also live centrally on a server, that you can put some first-class permissions around them, that you get to back up those systems. And so that's what we've tried to do by bringing Git into these systems, is give you the ability to do both. There's another session which is brand new that Marcel DeFries, he's one of our MVPs, is going to be doing. And Marcel has really tried to roll up a lot of best practices about open source development, particularly if you are an enterprise who might be considering investing in open source and using that as part of your projects. What are some of the things that you might need to consider or want to consider as you're starting to consider embracing open source? So I think that's going to be a very good session on Friday afternoon. And also somewhat related to code, although not directly related to Git, is a session that Stuart Kent is going to be doing. Stuart works on our Visual Studio Ultimate team on the architecture tooling that we have. And one of the newer things that we've invested in a lot recently are what are called code maps. Code maps allow you to easily decompose your solutions to be able to understand the way that code relates to one another and create really nice dynamically generated code maps, if you will, that allow you to quickly understand code that maybe you depend on or code that you wrote 6 months ago that you've just forgotten about. And I had a chance to review some of the demos that Stuart's working on. I think that's going to be a very good session later this evening. One of our announcements today is that I'm pleased to announce that we now have a European data center option for Visual Studio Online. So ever since we launched Team Foundation Service and later became Visual Studio Online, anytime you created an account, it was actually creating that in the United States. Well, we heard a lot of feedback from folks in Europe that said that we would love to use Visual Studio Online, but until you have a solution that's hosted both more locally to us and on European soil, we won't be able to consider it. So starting today, you can actually create a new account, and that will be created, if you choose Western Europe, when you create that account, that will be created in our data center in the Netherlands. I believe it's located just outside of Amsterdam. We do have plans to bring on more data centers over time, and so I expect that over the next year, we'll be bringing on more data centers. There is currently no option for moving an existing account, so if you already have Visual Studio Online in the United States, we are hard at work on bringing out the capability to allow you to move that over to Europe if you choose to do that. So hang tight if that's something that you're interested in. But what that means is that all of your account data will be stored in Europe if you choose this option. There are some user profile data that gets stored in North America centrally, but if you store any of your code or any of your work items, or if you run any load tests, all of that's going to be run from within Western Europe. So hopefully that will allow a lot more of you to consider that as an option. Jeff Beeler is in charge of our compliancy and our privacy for Visual Studio Online, and he has a brand new session that's happening on Thursday morning where he's going to be taking a look at some of the reasons that you might be challenged by your IT departments about whether or not Visual Studio Online is ready for you to use. And so he's put together a lot of different attributes about the service. He can talk more about how we secure it, how we treat your data, and I would encourage you to go take a look at that session if that's a topic that's of interest to you. Another announcement we have is a brand new way for you to quickly get started with load testing. Load testing is one of these capabilities that we've had in Visual Studio for years and years and years. And traditionally, when we had Visual Studio running on-premises with Team Foundation Server, the way that you would create a load test and run that is you would need to go maintain your own test rig of servers that would help you scale that load up and then hit your SharePoint farm or hit your public-facing website. And that's still an option for you. But what we found is that load testing tends to be one of these operations that it doesn't always make sense for you to invest in having your own test rig servers available. So sometimes when you just want to run a load test, you just want to say, scale this up to 10,000 users. That was a perfect scenario for us to bring to the cloud. And so we've had cloud-based load testing in Visual Studio Online for a little over a year now. What this new experience allows you to do is go straight to the web and configure your load test and point it at your web application without ever needing to open Visual Studio. And so you can scale that directly from the cloud. Now, of course, there are some more advanced scenarios that you might choose to use Visual Studio for, but we thought that this is a good way for a lot of people to get started doing load testing. Later this week, tomorrow morning, actually, Bernard and Brian Randall are going to be doing a session where they go much deeper into those tools. Bernard actually happens to be in Microsoft Consulting Services, so he has a lot of firsthand experience running load tests, and Brian has been presenting on these tools for quite some time. So I think that would be a good duo to present that session. If you are using Team Foundation Server today, one of the things that we've partnered with one of our partners around is delivering a solution to help you move from Team Foundation Server into Visual Studio Online. Now, I should say that this is a free tool. It's available to anyone who wants to try it. It doesn't work for Team Foundation Server templates that you may have customized. But if you have not customized your process template, you should be able to just run this tool, point it at a Visual Studio Online instance, and it will move all of your data, or copy your data rather, to the cloud. So you have some options about mapping users and saying this user that runs an Active Directory actually exists as this Live ID or Azure Active Directory user, so that they can try to maintain history for you. But this is for most people going to be the easiest way to move to Visual Studio Online if you care about preserving history. Now, a lot of customers that I'm seeing actually want to use both Team Foundation Server and Visual Studio Online together. This is important, especially if you have concerns around making sure that you have a local copy of your data, should you have access problems reaching the cloud. Sometimes there's compliance reasons why you might want to do this. So Stephen Borg has another session happening tomorrow evening where he'll be talking about some of the common use cases for both having Team Foundation Server and Visual Studio Online ready. Another one of the top requests we've had, especially from enterprise customers, is to provide support for Azure Active Directory in Visual Studio Online. So when we first launched the service, the way that you would sign up for Visual Studio Online and the way that you would add users was through Microsoft accounts, what used to be called Live IDs. And that provides a terrific mechanism for being able to collaborate with anyone in the world, because you don't have to make sure that they're added to your corporate Active Directory server. However, for a lot of organizations, especially enterprises, that's a requirement for them to be able to use a system like this. And so earlier this year, I'm pleased to say that we added support for Azure Active Directory, which means that you can actually use the same corporate directory that you might be using for your organization along with Visual Studio Online. When we first came out with this in the spring, it was only available for new accounts. And then within the last couple of months, we actually gave you the ability to link that back to existing accounts. It's a little bit more of a complex process to run through if you already have a Visual Studio Online account and you want to convert that to use Azure Active Directory, but it is possible. If you go to visualstudio.com and click on Get Started at the top, there's a help topic that describes how to do that. Now, even though Microsoft is a pretty big company, we understand that we aren't going to be able to build a solution that is perfect for everybody around the world. And so one of the things that we also released earlier this year is a first-class set of REST APIs for Visual Studio Online. I'm also pleased to announce that those REST APIs, they were in preview up until this morning, and this morning we actually took them out of preview. So those REST APIs are now declared 1.0, and if you are writing against any of the 1.0 REST APIs, you're guaranteed compatibility moving forward. And of course, we'll be adding some new APIs over time that are in preview that might go through some updates as we get feedback, and then eventually they'll stabilize as well. REST APIs are really nice because you can write applications that run on any device that understands REST, so any device really that can consume HTTP. We had a hackfest at Microsoft earlier this year, and there were quite a few teams who decided to build client applications that connect to Visual Studio Online. So in a matter of a day or two, they were able to build really nice applications for Windows Phone, Android, iOS, and so on that connected and consumed data straight from Visual Studio Online. One of the great things about the extensibility story here is that it does use OAuth, which means that you don't ever have to pass through credentials, that instead, when you write an application, the user can be prompted to say, do you trust this application to provide, to access your Visual Studio Online account? And if they want to revoke that later on, they have the right to do that. The other thing that we've made sure that's a first-class tenet here is service hooks. So if you haven't worked with service hooks before, service hooks basically get you out of the business of needing to pull a service periodically, and instead you effectively register your endpoint, and then when there's a change that's happened, such as a build is finished on the server or a work item has changed, then it will actually go back and call your service as opposed to you needing to constantly pull us. So we're seeing a lot of really great partners build some interesting solutions. Some of the most popular ones that I've seen here are integration with User Voice. So at TechEd North America, I had the CEO of User Voice on stage, and he showed how you can wire up User Voice to take suggestions directly from your User Voice and decide when you want to move those into actionable requirements for your development team, And so you can easily, with one click, move that over to your product backlog. Your development team can work on that. And then when they're done, it can go back to user voice to notify your users that you've implemented that requirement. So that's been a really popular one. There's a lot of great workflow engines out there. Zapier happens to be one that you can easily use to say, anytime this work item changes, I want you to send an email or create a tweet. Another thing that you can do, of course, is you can write your own code to integrate directly with Visual Studio Online. So you can, for example, integrate it with an internal help desk system that you might have so that you can wire up your operations and your support team directly with the development team. I'm very pleased to have here today my friend Nikhil. Nikhil's from one of our partner organizations, Azuqua, and Nikhil's going to come up and show a brand new integration that they've delivered with Visual Studio Online.
Hey, thanks, Brian.
Thanks for being here.
Hi, guys. Azuqua is a cloud connectivity platform that lets you connect disparate cloud services visually without any code so you can move data from one to the other and orchestrate business processes. So I'm going to go ahead and show you how we do this. So just to get started, I'm going to kick off a tweet, and then we'll talk about exactly what I'm doing. So I'm saying the save button is not working on my app. I'm going to tweet it out, and my tweet was posted. So what I'm essentially doing is, you know, as a developer, you're living in Visual Studio Online or your tools, and wouldn't it be great if all that information finds its way to you where you are working on an ongoing basis? So in this demo scenario, I'm letting me, as the maker of my phone app, actually collect bugs, harvest them through Twitter and into my Visual Studio Online. Now, a couple of things that need to get done is I need to first determine if this is bug worthy, if it's bad, and secondly, put a little triage process in the middle as well so that I can approve if that bug goes into Visual Studio or not. So let's go ahead into my email. I should have received a triage request. I've got this in here. I'll click on that, click on this link that I received, and it says, do you want, is this a bug or not? Submit yes. Go into my backlog items. You see I have about 11 over here. I'll refresh the page. And boom, there is the save button tweet that I had sent over, came into Visual Studio Online. So very quickly, I was able to connect Twitter with VSO.
That's great. And so at this point, you have a new bug that's in Visual Studio Online. What if you wanted to make sure that when you fixed this bug that your customers were notified?
Yeah, we could do that. What I would do is first, let me show you how this magic is actually created. We're going into the Azuqua Designer, and what I'm interested in is just monitoring Twitter. So I'll use Twitter. I'll say monitor keywords. My app is called My Phone App, so put in hashtag My Phone App right here. Flip it around, I get all of the fields from Twitter, and most of the cards, you know, services work the same way. And now what I want to do is I want to analyze if this is actually bug worthy. So I'll go in, look at the sentiment analyzer, tweet, figure out if this content is actually negative, and continue if the polarity of this content is equal to negative. B negative won't work, so negative. And at that point in time, I want to triage it now. So I'll go ahead and use, you know, some of the forms right here, display the form that you just saw. I want to drag the tweet that came through right here, get the content, and the data I want to ask is this a bug? You know, is this a bug? Configure this form right here and say the default value of this thing is no. Do a select. Yes, comma, no, which is exactly what you saw. Close this, and I'll put my notification email right here. Okay, so now when this is created, simply go ahead and say into my decision maker and say if bug equals yes, then go into Visual Studio and create a work item. So right here, what it's doing right now is actually logging into my Visual Studio, looking into the details, finding my apps, and getting the type of work items that I can actually create. So I'm going to create bug. It's gone ahead and brought the metadata for those items. I'll drag the content from Twitter over here and say new bug from Twitter. Save that, and voila, it's done. That's how easy it is to create a process and turn it on. Now, your question was that can I actually respond to people as well? So let's go ahead. I created a flow earlier. about the same thing, which is the Twitter to VSO with response. I'll edit that flow and it'll show me how I can go ahead, do the same thing, and actually respond to the user with the same ID that they respond, saying, hey, once the bug is fixed, you get notified that your bug is also fixed. So you could do this with Twitter or with other services as well.
Fantastic. And so what was your experience like using the REST APIs for Visual Studio Online? Was this a big investment for you, or?
The Visual Studio Online APIs are very well documented, industry standard. The service hooks functionality, as you mentioned, is pretty cool. We use that all over the place. So great experience. Because of that, Visual Studio is a first-class citizen on our platform as well.
Fantastic. Well, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Yep. That's terrific, and I really am excited about Azuqua, and I'm not just saying that because my friend Nikhil is here. I've used a lot of these services like If This Then That and Zapier, and they're easy to get started with, but eventually you run into this complexity problem where if you want to do some really interesting workflows, I find it to be very challenging, and I'm really excited that Nikhil is here to share Azuqua with us. Now, this is one session that you can't go to this week because, unfortunately, Will could not make it. But the good news is that if you follow this link, that will take you to the Channel 9 recording, where Will Smythe, who's the program manager in charge of these APIs, delivered a similar session at TechEd North America. So if you're interested in digging into the service and deciding if you want to build on top of Visual Studio Online, this is a great way to get started. You can also go to integrate.visualstudio.com, which is where all of our documentation is updated regularly. Now, I know you're probably thinking, I've pitched a lot of things to you today already, and we're not even halfway through yet. How can you stay up to date, especially since we're pushing out to Visual Studio Online on a three-week cadence, and we push out to Team Foundation Server on roughly every 3 to 4 months? The best way that I recommend to people is actually if you go to visualstudio.com, and at the very top, if you click on News, we have a features timeline. And this basically lists all of the features that we deliver into production. And on the left-hand side, you'll see exactly when they were introduced into the service. And on the right-hand side, you'll see when they are introduced into the on-premises product, Team Foundation Server. And so here, for example, test artifacts as work items. That was introduced on the service on October 14th, and it's already available with TFS 2013 Update 3. So that's a good way to stay up to speed, and you can also subscribe to the RSS feed for that timeline. I actually took that screenshot last night, and it's already out of date because they pushed another update this morning. So, for the rest of the presentation, I want to talk specifically about DevOps and go a little bit deeper into this industry movement, which we're very excited about and we're excited to support. If you're new to DevOps, I highly recommend that you take the time to read this book called The Phoenix Project. The Phoenix Project is to DevOps what the Agile Manifesto was to Agile. It also happens to be a very entertaining, fictional novel, but I think that as you read through the book, you'll quickly find characters and experiences that you can easily relate to. About the first 300 pages are just talking about all of the chaos that exists in this particular company called Parts Unlimited. And the protagonist of the story has inherited a lot of new job responsibilities and is responsible for trying to fix everything. And towards the end of the book, they talk about how he's managed to implement a DevOps practice within the Parts Unlimited company and all of the benefits that come about it. So even though it's a fictional book, it actually rings true, I think, for a lot of people who are facing these same challenges. And myself included, I learned a lot of things about the ways that we develop software that we've managed to embrace and also have learned from as we're building out these tools. And so in this book, the authors talk about what are called the three ways of embracing DevOps. The first way of DevOps is really to accelerate the process of moving from a piece of code that you've changed in your source control into having that code run in some environment. Now, whether that's a dev or test environment or a staging or production environment isn't really important. But what they do find is that a lot of the steps today that are required to go from development into some operational environment are oftentimes manual, oftentimes error-prone. And so if you can spend some time really focusing on trying to automate as much as possible, both on the provisioning side, the release management side, the quality assurance side, so that you can get into the habit of releasing more frequently, then you'll be able to unlock value much more rapidly and respond to business changes. Some of the most successful organizations in the world who have embraced DevOps actually push out to production hundreds of times per day. And that might sound very scary if you're an organization that's used to pushing to production once a quarter. But I promise you that the more you look at this, the more you start to realize that this, in my opinion, is the future. And so our commitment as Microsoft, both in Visual Studio and across the other technologies that we represent, is to really as much as possible make this easier for you to take advantage of by giving you the automated provisioning tools and the release management tools and the quality assurance tools to help you realize this possibility. So I'll be talking a little bit more about the first way. Before I do, let me talk about the second way, which is once you can actually push out to production more frequently, it's going to become very important for you to understand exactly what's going on in those environments. If you have a bug, what exactly is happening? I just made a change over here which caused a bug in production. I need to know exactly what that bug was. So I need to get that data back to my development team very quickly so that they can turn around a fix. Or maybe you just want to be able to make your code more easy to use by customers. Well, it would be nice to know if you just invested 3 weeks on a particular feature, are customers actually using it? Are they finding that feature? Maybe they find it and they have a bad experience with that feature. So that's where our products like Application Insights come into play, and I'll be talking a little bit more about that. We also have some other sessions. And then once you can start to do both the first way and the second way more quickly and more reliably, then you can start to unlock some of these new development paradigms like build, measure, learn, or hypothesis-driven development. It's really fascinating, even just looking at the internal teams that I work with, where we are able to do things that we would have never dreamed of even 3 years ago. We might build a feature, push it out to 100 customers, see how they use it, and then based on that, we might decide very quickly that this is a feature that nobody wants. Nobody wants to use it. Or maybe they want it, but they can't discover it. Or maybe they discover it and they have a bad experience with it. And so it really allows you to get very smart about how you spend your development resources and ultimately drive up the customer value. So let's talk a little bit more about the first way of DevOps. And I'm going to throw at you several technologies that I think you should have on your radar, which Microsoft is investing in. The first of these is desired state configuration. Desired state configuration is an evolution of PowerShell, which allows you to declaratively model exactly what a Windows environment needs to be configured as in order to support your application requirements. And so desired state configuration is something that you as a development team can author. It's also something that I would encourage you to work with your IT professional colleagues to see if they want to invest in those capabilities as well. We're coming out with a lot of tooling support in Visual Studio to make it easier for you to work with desired state configuration. One of the things that desired state configuration can do is actually look at a target deployment environment and determine, based on what's currently configured in that environment, what do I need to do in order to make it look like what the developer or the IT professional wanted it to do. And so, more often than not, what we're seeing organizations do as they embrace DevOps is actually take all of these DSC files and store them in source control and version them alongside the application code. And that gives you really a high guarantee method for being able to make sure that your application code is able to determine exactly what's going to be on those environments. The other thing that DSC can do is it can actually be run in this configuration drift mode. So it can look at a server and make sure that if somebody, you know, on the operations side walks up to that server and disables a feature that they don't think is being used, DSC can actually flip that back to enabled and file a message that tells you something changed on that server. Don't worry, we fixed it, but you probably need to make sure that you put some checks and balances in place so that that is actually flowing across your continuous deployment pipeline as opposed to letting people change that server directly. On the cloud, we're investing heavily in providing the ability for you to declaratively model your cloud resources as well. And so you may have seen Azure Resource Groups, which we announced at the Build Conference earlier this year. Azure Resource Groups allow you to encapsulate all of the different resources that you require in your public cloud application, and you can actually treat those containers of resource groups independently of one another. So you might have a resource group that represents your development environment, your test environment, your staging, and so on. And this is much better than the current state of the art, which is that you go to the Azure Resource portal, you spin up a virtual machine, you spin up a database, you spin up a cloud storage account, and it's kind of left up to you to remember what the association is between those various resources. When you start moving into Azure Resource Groups, it becomes immediately clear that this virtual machine depends on this SQL Azure account, and so on. To go with that, we have a new declarative model called Azure Resource Manager, which allows you to script using JSON exactly what you want to be represented in those environments. And so you can then take those same files, you can check those into source control, and you can start to continuously deploy those so that every time you deploy, we say, do you have this virtual machine available? If not, let's provision it. The next time we deploy, it's already there, so we don't need to provision it, but we might need to configure some new feature that your application requires. And finally, you'll see us bringing these not only from the public cloud where they exist today, but also to the private cloud as well. So they're not currently in the Azure pack, but you will start to see us introduce those over time, where you're going to have a consistent set of APIs for managing all of your cloud resources, whether those are running in Microsoft Azure public cloud or on-premises in our private cloud technologies like System Center and Azure Pack. So look for that as kind of the future direction of where we're headed in this space. Now, there's a lot more details that I'm not covering here today, but if these technologies are new to you, I would definitely encourage you to go check out this overview presentation on desired state configuration, which is happening tomorrow afternoon, and then this session, which really talks about the Azure Resource Group and Azure Resource Manager technologies that I talked about, happening on Friday at noon. Another important aspect of the first way of DevOps, moving from dev into operations, is this idea of release management. Especially in an enterprise, it's very important for you to be able to understand who is signing off on a release before it goes into production. What is in a particular release? Where is a release in the release pipeline? Did we have any errors with a particular deployment, and how do we roll those back? And so about a year and a half ago, Microsoft acquired one of our partner companies called InRelease. They had built a great solution for doing release management on top of Team Foundation Server. And so we realized that was a very important aspect of development, and we wanted to bring that into our engineering team. So they're now part of the Visual Studio engineering team, and they provide a solution for helping you to orchestrate all of the different lifecycle stages and environments that you might care about. I'm going to show you a demo of that in a moment, but I also just wanted to mention that that earlier this summer, we also added DSC support to that. We also added Chef support as well. So as part of your release management pipeline, you can call out to a Chef recipe on Linux or call out to a DSC script running on Windows, and that can do all of the configuration on that particular environment. And I'm going to show you just a quick demonstration here of how that works. So this is the release management client that we shipped today. You'll notice here that I have an application which is configured. In this particular application, I have three different release pipeline stages. So here I've modeled dev, QA, and production. And as part of modeling these different pipeline flows, you get to decide exactly what happens when you go to deploy your application. And so we might go configure an IIS application and make sure that we deploy the code into that particular path. But the other thing that you can do is you can also easily configure governance and controls about who gets to sign off on a particular release. So here you can see, for example, that that I'm the approver for our development environment, but by the time it gets out to the operation or out to the production environment, we need to make sure that all the deployments and the validation are actually handled by our operations team. So that allows us to get very tight controls, if we want that approach, over exactly who is pushing out to each one of these environments. Another thing that we introduced earlier this year is support for being able to link up our release management system with your Azure subscription. So here you can see that I've created another environment which pushes directly to my Azure IaaS virtual machines. I've provided my MSDN subscription certificate so that it knows how to deploy out to my MSDN subscription. You could, of course, also use a production enterprise agreement subscription if you wanted to. And then the other thing that we did that I just mentioned is adding support for DSC as well. So in this pipeline, you'll notice it's a very simplified view. I just have a single step, and it's basically pointing out to the DSC file, which I'm storing in source control. So these two files right here make up my desired state configuration workflow. The first of these defines which steps and actions I perform, and then the second allows me to provide a configuration file, which might vary if I'm pushing out to development versus production, because it might have different ports and different credentials and database names and so on. And so if I open up Visual Studio, you'll see that I've taken those two files and I'm version controlling them directly within Team Foundation Server. So here you can see where it's defining exactly which roles I need to configure. I need to have ASP.NET 4.5 turned on, IIS, and so on. And then here's my configuration file, which specifies the variables that I need to pass into that first file. So for example, if my IT department came along and said, you know, we don't want you using default ports, but here's the port that we want you to use, it would just be a matter of updating it in place, checking that into source control, kicking off that build, and then pushing it out as a new release. One last thing in the release management tool is that we give you very good traceability for being able to understand exactly what's running as part of those workflows. So here you can see I kicked off a workflow this morning, which had a brand new IaaS virtual machine that needed to be configured in order to support my environment. And so here you can see that it's copying all my files. It's investigating and determining that IIS was not enabled, so it's going to go enable that. It's going to turn on ASP.NET 4.5, and so on and so forth. So you can see it's very easy for you to go back later on and understand exactly what was happening in that environment. Some great sessions here this week on release management that are going to go a lot deeper than I had time for just now. The first of those sessions is going to be taking a look at release management as an overview and going end-to-end for deploying out to a variety of Windows-based environments. And so that session's happening tomorrow morning. And then on Friday, Donovan's doing a talk on cross-platform release management. So if you need to use Chef, if you want to deploy Java applications, that's going to be a really excellent presentation. Donovan was one of our top-rated speakers at TechEd North America earlier this year, so this is his first time to TechEd Europe. We were excited to invite him. So I hope you'll go make him feel at home. Now, one of the most common scenarios that we're seeing people starting to embrace the cloud for is dev test. So I know, especially in Europe, it's a little bit behind where we're at in places like North America, where we're starting to use the cloud for a lot of production workloads. But what we are seeing a lot of in Europe is using the cloud for dev test workloads. And so whereas today, if you want to go spin up a dev test lab, you have to go acquire that hardware and provision it yourself and maintain it yourself, we've actually invested in a lot of tooling experiences for making it very easy for you to go provision things in the cloud that might be related to dev and test. And in fact, as part of your MSDN subscription, if you're an MSDN subscriber, you actually get substantial Azure credits every month. You do have to go to the Azure portal, I'm sorry, to the MSDN subscription portal and activate your benefit. But then once you do that, based on the level of Azure or the level of MSDN you have, you'll get either $50, $100, or $150 of credits. And so just as an example, if you have $100 of credits per month, you can actually run 3 virtual machines for 16 hours a day. So it's quite substantial. You can spend those Azure credits on just about any Azure resource that you want to for dev and test purposes. Another thing that we released earlier this year was Windows client images for MSDN subscribers to do dev tests. So that was a popular request. It's been available in the portal for a few months now, but I just mentioned this because a lot of people that I talked to still were not aware that that's available now. Now let's talk just very briefly about the second way of DevOps, which is I have an application, it's running out in an environment, and I want to understand, is it available? Can my customers reach it? Is it performing well? You know, it might be that my customers can reach it, but they're having a lot of exceptions or it's running really slowly. And finally, are my users successful with it? And these are the three attributes that our application insights team is working hard on. And so this is... the screenshots you see here are the set of application insights dashboards that exist within Visual Studio Online. What they're doing now is they're actually bringing all of those dashboards into the Azure Preview Portal. And I'm going to show that to you in just a moment. So the Azure Preview Portal, I didn't talk about yet, but it is basically a new experience that we're building to replace the existing Azure Management Portal. And it gives us a great opportunity to bring together a lot of both the development and operational attributes of the applications that you'll be running in the cloud. And so this is a customized dashboard I created. This happens to be based on a real application. So if you've ever visited the Microsoft Office blog, they actually host that as Azure websites on top of Azure. And I have co-admin access, which means that I could create a dashboard that allows me to easily see exactly what's going on in that experience. You'll see right away that I decided that I wanted to see the state of Azure around the world. Most of the time, that actually has green check boxes next to every one of the services, but unfortunately, there's some outages in some of the services this morning. The good news is that I've actually pinned the tiles that represent the services that I depend on, and none of those services have any problems. And so at a glance, I can quickly see if any Azure services are at risk. You can also easily see what your estimated spend is for the current month. So I actually have 2 websites in here, 1 production and 1 staging, and you can see exactly how much you're anticipating to spend that month. And so that's really been a top customer request, is make sure I can easily understand how much this is costing me. And then you can also see these Azure resource groups I was describing earlier. And so here in this particular Azure resource group, you can see that it consists of a staging website, of a production website, of a hosting plan, and of application insights data. If you had a SQL Azure server in there as well, then you would be able to see that linked. And any of the other Azure resources that you depend on can be added to that Azure resource group so that you can easily manage the lifecycle of those resources. And if you decide later on that you want to retire an application, you can delete the entire resource group without, you know, potentially forgetting about some database that you are still paying for. And you can also start to get a lot of application insights data directly in the portal as well. So application insights is responsible for delivering these charts and graphs. And here you can see exactly how much CPU and memory is being used by your application. You can see all of the requests and errors. I'm just showing you the very tip of the iceberg here. There's another session that is happening later this week by Peter Provost. And I would encourage you to go take a look at that session as well. Actually, he has 2 sessions. The first is an overview session where he's going to be going across all of the different capabilities that Application Insights provides. He'll be explaining how to get started with those capabilities. And then in the second session, it's a 300-level session, he'll be going much deeper into how you can instrument your application and understand exactly how users are interacting with it. So are they using these features? Is this code getting exercised? Are your customers having a good experience with your applications? That's, of course, very critical to understand. There's another session that's happening on the Azure Preview Portal itself. And so if you want to learn more about what I just showed you, how you can set up your own portal, how you can configure continuous deployment to go straight from Visual Studio Online and push out into the resource groups that I just showed you, then definitely check out Chandrika's session later on this evening. And then there's another event that is happening that you should put on your calendars. This is November 12th. This is what we're calling the Connect event. So we're working on the next version of Visual Studio, what we've codenamed as Dev 14. We've released some community technology previews of Dev 14 already, but we have a lot more that we'll be sharing with you on November 12th related to the next version of Visual Studio, the next version of .NET, as well as some cloud capabilities that we'll be sharing with you as well. So that event actually takes place primarily online. You can go mark your calendars. On November 12th, we'll have a series of keynotes happening that you can view, and I think it'll be an exciting time to share some more information with you. So that's aka.ms/connect. And that's it, really. So I'll spend a few minutes taking questions. If you get a chance, please take time to evaluate this session and give us feedback. I really appreciate you taking the time with us. And I have about 5 minutes if people want to ask questions. But if you decide you want to go to lunch early, that's okay with me, too. Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you. Sure.